happening now. We want to welcome our viewers from across the United States and around the world. This is the EdTech Situation Room. Good morning, good day, good evening. This is EdTech Situation Room, episode number 319 on January 31st, 2024. I cannot believe it's the last day of January. But hey, my name is Jason Neifer. I am the executive director of Montana Digital Academy, which is Montana's fabulous state virtual school located on the beautiful University of Montana campus right here in Missoula, Montana, the heart of Western Montana. And joining me tonight, as always, good evening, Dr. Westfryer. How are you tonight, sir?
Good evening, Jason. I am doing well, and I understand you have had a heat wave, and now you're going to brace for more snow. So nothing like crazy weather, right?
It's bizarre. And, well, first of all, the last 2 days, there's been such thick fog in Missoula that, I mean, like this morning, I had to drive 10 miles an hour down the street because I couldn't see more than 10 feet in front of me. So that's weird. And then, Missoula is a, I mean, we're a mountain state, you know, in the far north. So, it gets cold here. And, last week we had a whole day where it just dumped rain all day in January. And so, yeah, it's bizarre. And there's no snow in the mountains. I am very concerned about the drought in Montana. I'm very concerned about fires in Montana. So we'll have to see. I was told it was supposed to be a snowier winter because of El Nino, but it turns out, who knows? So I
and after maybe tonight, maybe after tonight, maybe people will be more concerned about the risk of Chinese cyber attack. So, you know, the but we have some good news. We have some good news coming from the Webb Space Telescope, ladies and gentlemen. So don't completely give up all hope.
Yeah, it's funny that we actually have to have a category called good miscellaneous news because it counterbalances everything else. So
I felt that was probably even, you know, better than just miscellaneous tonight.
Yep.
Well, what are we gonna do? What are these topics that you speak of?
Well, the EdTech Situation Room podcast is a once-a-week podcast where we take a look at the news headlines and technology and kind of shoot them through the prism of education to see if this technology news can provide any insight of what's going on in classrooms of all shapes and sizes. And tonight we have topics including, of course, artificial intelligence, including some AI hardware news, AI impact news, AI image harms. I'm sure that discussion will get a hearty discussion out of the both of us. We also have some security news, including some breaking news about potential risks that I think you need to be aware of, dear listener. Hardware news, tech correction news, Apple news in a couple of different varieties. The positive miscellaneous news concerning the Webb telescope, as it turns out. And we'll end tonight with our so-called Geek of the Week. Dr. Fryer, where would you like to start tonight?
Gosh, I almost think we should start positive, but I won't. Let's save it because we'll need it. We'll need it for later.
Yeah.
I think we should do this breaking news. So yes. Put this under security. There were a couple pretty substantial testimonies given today in Washington, D.C., and this one was the FBI director. So this is from CNN today on January 31st. The headline is, FBI director warns that Chinese hackers are preparing to wreak havoc on U.S. critical infrastructure. And this actually ties to one of my Geeks of the Week, which is a podcast. But we've heard this before, but I do not think we've heard the director of the FBI speak as dramatically in front of Congress in terms of saying that, you know, what was that? There was some Halloween, you know, horror movie where it was like the phone calls coming from inside the house, you know, and that's basically what this is, that the Chinese are inside the house in the critical infrastructure that we have, not only with our power grid, but with water, sewage treatment. They have a statistic in there. Ray is the WRAY is the FBI director. They estimate that China's cyber operatives outnumber FBI agents 50-1. And so they are trying to, you know, raise awareness. I know that sometimes when things like this happen, you know, especially when it involves budget, you know, people are suspicious that, oh, it's just the military industrial complex, the security state, you know, seeking to get more money. And clearly they are. but I don't think that the majority of folks have a very good awareness about how much we rely upon, you know, digital technologies on the internet. I mean, we do, but I don't think we're putting the pieces together in terms of defending for this. And unfortunately, just given the circumstances and where we are today, as a free and open society, and as they point out in this article, one that hasn't really held folks liable for not patching things, cyber threats are really huge. And the scenario here, dear debate friend, probably is Taiwan war, right? Because, and this, you know, we hear North Korea say things every year. We hear, you know, sometimes President Xi, there was evidently a pledge that Xi, the president of China, gave to Biden that China would not interfere in the elections. But they have continued to pronounce over and over again that they are going to take Taiwan back, and it's China. And, you know, that's one of these scenarios that if you're a debater, you know, you know about, you know, Taiwan nuke scenario, nuke war scenarios, and, you know, the reliance that we and the whole world has upon microchips. But I should say the Western world, because China is, you know, attempting, I don't know, because I have no classified access, but I don't think that they're, you know, quite where they want to be with chip production. But this was very somber news, and I think this was alarming news. So, your thoughts?
Yeah, and it yes, it is alarming news. But I would also say too, I thought of two things when I saw this headline. The first one is that, I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that international bad actors would love to wreak additional havoc on our election system, right? In part because we're at such heightened sensitivity in the 2024 election that even an external actor doing something unsavory might lead to an internal strife in the United States that would be way worse than the crime itself from the external actor. And, you know, say what you want about the current political situation in the United States, but, you know, outside countries know that we're in a rough patch right now, and that the United States is not unified as a country. And we've never been universally unified, or at least not 100% of folks. Even in times of significant country unification, our country very proudly says that there are many instances in which, you know, we have protesters or those that dissent. But secondarily, I'm also very concerned because one of the ways to wreak maximum havoc is to aim at the schools, because again, and I think I've said almost this entire same phrase probably a half dozen times on our podcast, but it remains very true. Yes, it is unpleasant when student data is linked, for example, but in the grand scheme of things, that's relatively minor from a privacy standpoint. But the bottom line is that it creates a lot of havoc and hand-wringing and division, right? And it's easy to start pointing fingers back and forth. So, you know, as an example, I would imagine most educational institutions, and if not, you should do this, be warning your end users. That includes students and teachers and staff members and everyone that you're responsible for managing their accounts. You know, tell them to be extra careful. You know, we get regular phishing attacks in my day job organization. We luckily have never been directly targeted or received anything that has led to significant havoc over our 14 years as an organization. But of course, we are just one of many educational institutions in the state of Montana. Others have had significant issues with data release and threats with that data. So even if you're not a security-minded person, now's the time to be extra cautious. And, you know, I will probably go and change. I have about 10 or 15 passwords between my personal accounts and my work accounts that I would consider to be sensitive. I'm going to change those in the next couple of weeks. And I do that every couple of months now. And in fact, I was complaining today that I'm going to have to change one account of mine again, because the password I picked a couple of weeks ago is too hard to type. So that's not what I'm going for. So kind of important stuff from there. But yeah, very, very good to share this information, Dr. Fryer. And, you know, I would say to all those listening, I get that it seems like the same threats over and over again, but take this seriously.
This isn't going to be my Geek of the Week, but I'll just throw it in. I've been sharing intermittently, you know, things about being a prepper, preparing for emergencies. And, you know, winter storms happen and things take place. Yeah. And I would just say that in addition to considering how we might contact our elected representatives and ask them to take this seriously and look at the ways in which, you know, steps can be taken to try and secure critical infrastructure, you know, I won't go off in a big rabbit hole with this, but I would just say, you know, FEMA gives advice about being prepared, having some things stocked up. I think during the pandemic, you know, that was a wake up call for a lot of folks who were, you know, possibly not having as much, you know, stored up at home. And the other thing to probably say is, I mean, I hesitate to say that it is going to be inevitable that we're going to have some kind of significant cyber attack, but that would be my inclination. I do not think that is going to bring the entire world to an end. You know, we did, I mean, Montana and the West is definitely a state that has a reputation of being, you know, very resilient and very independent. Lots of the world, you know, I mean, it's relatively new that we've had a power grid and we've been so dependent upon it. That does put our society at a unique type of risk, especially in large cities. But, you know, we are a resilient people, and, you know, this is why we need to think about community and how we're going to, you know, be able to band together as not only just, you know, within our family, but with our community and our neighbors and things like that. So I don't want to, you know, there is a lot of negative news, and there's no doubt about it. But I think there are clear proactive things that we can do. It's more than just wringing our hands. And I really think this is significant. It's the biggest, you know, other than what we saw with Cambridge Analytica and the hoopla of that. But then that just seemed to sort of confuse people, and people, oh, did Russia, you know, mess with this? I don't know. It's just so obfuscated. It's like the UFO issue. Well, I don't know. It's just, it's so confusing. We can't draw any conclusions. This is a very clear statement by the person who has the most intelligence about this in the entire country. And I do not think he's just saying it for a self-serving purpose of, boy, I hope I can boost my budget this year. So I think we should consider what this means for us, you know, both personally and then together as a group. So yay, there's a very happy note to start on.
Yeah. We really knocked the positivity out of that one. So,
Maybe we should talk about the Webb Space Telescope. You want to do that?
Yeah, let's do it. Go for it.
Okay. So, I mean, we don't do this all the time, but I do love to share space news with my students. There are so many things going on that if we don't have someone in our life who is, you know, mentioning, hey, do you know what the Webb Space Telescope folks just announced? I mean, we may just never hear it, right? And I do think that space is a very positive, you know, thing in terms of exploration and the things we're discovering. So I do love to look at pictures of, you know, telescope images of nebula and galaxies. And so this is from NASA's official Webb mission team. And basically the summary of this is scientists are saying their minds are being completely blown by the degree of detail that these new images from Webb are revealing about the universe. And it is just incredible. And they're saying in here, you know, galaxies may live billions or trillions of years. I hear Carl Sagan's voice, you know, talking and saying that kind of thing. But if you go all the way down to the bottom of the article, and I'll link to it too, I'll drop this in, the full set of 19 images, you know, is directly available. And so in the midst of, you know, a lot of negative news, I mean, let's look at our amazing universe and the ways in which technology and engineering and collaboration, right? Because, oh my goodness, this is a huge collaborative project. If you haven't watched some of those videos detailing all the things that the Webb Space Telescope had to get exactly perfect, you know, in order to be successful, it really does inspire me. And so anyway, this is quick, but it may not be something that caught your attention, but it's worth considering because, oh my gosh, as human beings on the planet, we've never looked as deeply into our universe as you can on your laptop right now, clicking this link. And that's really amazing. And we probably shouldn't just take that for granted. So yay, there's some positive to counterbalance a little bit tonight. Do you have a telescope, by the way?
Do I have a telescope?
Yeah. Have you ever done
it? I have the one that my mom gave me when I was 10, somewhere in the basement, but that's about the extent to it. And I do love space stuff. I particularly, I'm fascinated by the space station. I think that's something that it's super interesting. And also, the Mary Roach book about the potential of space travel kind of talks about how gross it is too, because it's not a very hospitable environment for humans. Now that you've said that, packing for Mars, and it talks about, actually, I love Mary Roach. If you've ever read any Mary Roach stuff, Wes, you would enjoy her. It's kind of creative nonfiction about science topics. There's also, she wrote a book called Stiff, which is about dying, and it's super good. But she talks about things like a couple of the early experimental missions, Apollo and Gemini missions. There was a problem because someone kept dropping pellets of feces into the cabin, and it's like floating around and like pretty gross stuff. But yeah, the Mary Roach book is pretty outstanding.
One other thing I'd say about that is, in the midst of thinking about, oh my gosh, what might happen, if the grid goes down for a while or we have these things, there's so much that we've learned from the space program. There's a fantastic Matt Damon water special. ISS, right, completely recycles their water. And so there are places in Scandinavia now where they're designing houses that 100% recycle their water. And I know people are like, oh my gosh, that's gross. Hey folks, it's science. And, the astronauts aren't staying up there, for a year and drinking water that is not pure. I mean, they are. So anyway, I think there's so many reasons why it's great to study space, great to talk about space. Thank you for mentioning Mary Roach, because that I put that link in here, and I am just adding Packing for Mars to my Amazon reading list or wish list.
Yeah. And I will also say, those are great audiobooks too. They're really great to drive to Mary Roach with. So
awesome. Awesome. Okay. All right. Well, take us somewhere else, Dr. Neifer.
Where sure. Would you like? Well, I just want to do a quick hardware thing, because this is super interesting to me, what's going on here. Amazon, I can't remember if we reported this a couple weeks back. I know I read about it for sure, but Amazon is saying that they're dropping Android on the Fire TV stick. They're moving towards what looks like a custom operating system, and it's called Vega OS. To quote from this article from 9to5 Google, Amazon was looking for a Fire TV experienced software development engineer. The job's listing description made it abundantly clear that a key part of the role was focused on the transition from Android to the rumored Vega OS, because it quite literally says that's what's happening, with Amazon saying that Fire TV is transitioning from FOS Android to native/Rust, and even explicitly mentioning React Native. And what's really interesting about that to me is that, assuming that maybe this is on tap for tablet devices too from Amazon, that's going to make those devices way less useful. One of the things, I do own a tablet or two from Amazon. They're fun to play with. They're fun to hack. So if you like, hacking firmware and playing around with things in that way, it's pretty great. Because I've taken the 11 and 7-inch Amazon Fire tablets, and which are based on Android, and I've been able to add the Play Store to them and effectively recreate an Android-like experience for relatively inexpensively. But something I know from what I still do in the Android atmosphere is that the store, the Fire TV store, is just a ghost town, and the apps on there are terrible. There's the, at one point they had a YouTube app. They don't have the YouTube app anymore. They kind of go back and forth. And if you are a Fire TV or Fire tablet customer, that experience keeps getting worse for some reason, even though the hardware itself is getting better and better. In fact, the premium Android tablets in 2024 are, you know, medium spec Android tablets, right? Enough RAM in them, a high enough resolution screens, but they're a pretty good deal, especially if you can hack the Play Store onto it and get access to all those apps. So I find it interesting that Amazon's going in this way. I don't know if there's enough users in the Amazon world for major developers to release apps on the Amazon App Store if they move to this native operating system with their tablets. But I do find this to be a pretty extraordinary development.
It is going to be so interesting to see where smart assistants and the IoT devices that we're plugging into our screens go. We don't need to drop it in, but on that same... was it 9to5? What was the source on that? 9to5 Google. They were talking about maybe the renaming of the Google Assistant as Bard comes in, right? Yep. I am already having multiple conversations with ChatGPT via the app, right? That's on the phone. And I want to be able to engage in conversations with a smart assistant that is as smart as ChatGPT-4 is. Actually, I'd love to have one that's more. And we are. We're that's coming. So it's going to be super interesting to see, especially how does ChatGPT in its next iterations get into a smart speaker that is not just on your phone or in your computer. And so I will predict that Microsoft will make a play into this area because of its investment and stake in OpenAI and ChatGPT. And that's going to be really, really interesting because we've, you know, pretty much seen Amazon and Google and Apple, you know, duke it out here. Now, we haven't had Apple's arrival to the AI space yet, and presumably they're going to be, you know, integrating that into their existing speakers. Are you happy, by the way, with your Apple speaker? I know you made a sizable investment months ago, I guess. And are you pleased with it at this point?
Here would be my two relatively minor criticisms. The first one is that it does have a big booming sound. I'm not sure if I'm enough of an audiophile to know if it's the premium sound I paid for. And that sounds silly, right? Because, you know, I've had this argument with true audiophiles before that if you don't care or you can't tell and you think it sounds good, then shut up because it sounds good, right? You got what you needed. That's a minor one. And the other one is too, that you can't, ping it via Bluetooth. So there is no Bluetooth option for these speakers. And that, I think, is a superpower of the Amazon speakers, is that you, even if you don't want to be in the Madam A world, you're certainly able to Bluetooth to it. And from that standpoint, they're actually pretty great Bluetooth speakers. And so I'm probably going to end up focusing on Apple only products. My wife and I are an iOS. I do have a couple of Alexa speakers, a Google speaker or two, somewhere around. And at some point I just probably need to scrap those. But, the bottom line is that, you know, HomeKit's pretty great, you know, for all of our stuff that that my wife and I share. You know, it's all in the Apple universe. And so I think it makes sense to go in that direction.
I hadn't thought of this before, but I think I mentioned that I had picked up an Apple TV for almost a wish. I mean, it was one of those things too, where I was just hoping it wasn't, you know, stolen goods. I have never looked for a Google smart speaker, and we're very invested in the Google, you know, ecosystem at this point. And I think we have four. We have one display, the smaller one, and then we've got, you know, three or four speakers. We've had one speaker die on us, but in general, fantastic, very happy. And we're just like the Harry Potter Hogwarts around here. You know, I've got these different custom spells that we say, and you walk in and we have somebody watch our dogs. We have to say, well, to turn on the lights, you're going to have to say this. You know, it's just like, I don't know how many people are doing that these days. But, yeah, I think, I will take a look at the marketplace and see, cause I would assume, are you going to probably sell your Google speakers and your other ones or get rid of them?
I am, although Dr. Fryer, it would be my pleasure just to send them to you. So, let me see what I've got in stock here. And then, maybe that's a good thing for us to do.
There you go. You can just call that an early birthday present.
Yeah, so. There you go.
Well, I predict that for actually the next holiday, it'll be interesting because these kinds of products, you know, Internet of Things, of course, you're opening yourself up, I know, to, you know, attack and hacks and things like that. So it's important. It's still really the realm of pretty geeky folks, or I think wealthy folks that can pay, you know, media integrators to come into their house and get all of it set up, because I am now no longer installing the, you know, light switches, which are, you know, have firmware in them. It's just so much better to, you know, use a plug or an actual light bulb, depending upon your application. And so anyway, it's fun. It's fun to dabble with that and experiment. Right up to the point where you're, you know, living in Mr. Robot for real. Let's hope, you know, that didn't happen. I never saw all of those episodes, but you know, if you want to see what it might look like in a dystopian future when your, you know, Internet of Things home is hacked, I think that's in the first episode there. All right. Very good. Can we do a little, I don't know. We're going to have to go to AI. We're not quite halfway done. Should we do tech correction or should we do jump into some AI stuff? Or Apple. Tech correction. Okay.
Well, let's do a quick Apple here. I just wanted to note that the Apple Vision Pro is being released this week, and I'm sharing two reviews tonight. One of them is from The Verge, who has a pretty, I would call it, sour review of the Vision Pro. And to be clear, I would agree that with most of their criticisms here, even though their conclusions are what I would say mixed. But they talk about how it's really the best headset ever made. And they talk about how, you know, the platform itself, it needs a lot of work. The hardware needs a lot of work. They talk about how ridiculously expensive it is. They spend some time, talking about how inconsistent the controls are, especially the hand and eye movement tracking, yada, 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 yada. But, in the end, it's the first version, right? I remember back to the iPad, and I thought the iPad was a pretty snazzy device when I bought a first generation iPad. I bought it the day it came out, and enjoyed the platform. But what I would also tell you about that that's also true is that a lot of people hated that. They made fun of the iPad as a poorly named, ridiculous piece of hardware. And, you know, I know a lot of people whose primary computer is an iPad. That's certainly true of my mom. That's true of several family members of mine. That's how they use the internet, right? And then the other I wanted to share with you was the Daring Fireball review by John Gruber, a prominent voice in the Apple world. And basically what he says is that if you watch a movie in movie mode on it, you're going to grab your wallet, is the summary from him. And I thought those were two interesting juxtapositions of those two pieces, but I'm not going to be a candidate for Vision Pro version 1. I might not be a candidate for Vision Pro 2 or 3, in part because I don't have a use case for it. I have plenty of screens that I can watch things on, and I'm interested in the interaction. I hope I get a chance to put one on my head at some point in the near future, because I'd like to know more about the thing itself. But the bottom line is that I'm happy just to watch this debate.
Let's all keep our eyes open for when the Apple Store has the availability of the Vision Pro to try it out, because that's, I'm guessing, going to be the first opportunity that I'll have to see it. Did we report last week, or maybe I read it somewhere else, that YouTube is not going to be an app on it?
I don't remember, because I remember either listening or talking about that too, but YouTube is not on there. Netflix is not on there.
And that's huge. That is absolutely huge.
And you can get to it via the Safari browser, right? You can still watch YouTube videos and still watch Netflix, but it will be a much less a solid experience than if it was something custom created for the Vision Pro.
Well, I know this is your article, but on that note, it kind of segues to your last article or your last Apple. Do you want to do the Chrome and Firefox?
Yeah, this one's wild. So there's been a lot of media in the last week about the new rules. I believe we talked about them last week, that Apple is ticking off an awful lot of people because they're enforcing a bunch of new rules for apps that are downloaded or sold through alternative app stores. That's a mandatory thing in Europe that's coming to the United States. In a lot of cases, they're collecting more money in the app store than they were when they were actually doing the app store itself. But this is, I've been very clear in the past that I think that 30% seems a little steep for me, but I do think that developers that have apps on the App Store and make money from them do owe Apple some funding, right? I don't know if 30% is the right number. I don't know if 10% is enough, but I don't know enough about that part of the business to know that for sure. But I do think it's important that Apple do allow some different interpretations of some of the ways they've been going about things. And this is, a lot of people don't know this, but any web browser you download on an iOS device has what's called WebKit under it, which is Apple's framework for displaying the web. So if you're on a Chrome browser, it's built on top of WebKit. There may be Chrome things on there like signing in and your passwords and features that are built on top of it, but the actual rendering engines are Apple's. And that's something they've enforced consistently for the past 13 years. And so what has always been super interesting about that to me is that you can't really innovate in that space, because if you have a faster rendering engine, you'll never know because it's not on there. Well, with the new rules in the EU, Apple's going to open up its platform to other browser engines. And so the Chromium engine is another example of an engine. It underlines Chrome and underlies the Edge browser from Microsoft. And as it turns out, they will, in the EU at least, allow you to download all sorts of other engines, including Chromium-based browsers, Gecko, which is Firefox's, and then there's also another one that I know less about called Blink. So that could be really interesting, because I think that could change, you know, the way that you render web pages on mobile.
And that article explains that the reason for this is Europe's Digital Markets Act, or DMA, not to be confused with the DMCA, and it stipulates, quote, among other things, that users should be allowed to uninstall pre-installed apps, including web browsers that, quote, steer them to the products and services of the gatekeeper, end quote. So I think this is fascinating. You know, even though we do have alternative browsers now on the iPhone, with Chrome and Firefox and others, you know, Safari has definitely been my go-to. You know, advertising is a huge part of this. And I don't know if we'd included last week, but like the billions of dollars that some people are estimating marketers and advertisers, and companies are going to lose, just the market itself is going to shrink dramatically because of some of the privacy things, not only that Europe has done, but because of some other factors, it's going to be super interesting. I think that isn't it weird how we just continue to lag behind Europe? I mean, maybe this is just a sign of political ineffectiveness or gridlock, right? But you know, we've been at this a while as far as our show, and you know, we have yet to say, well, the United States looks like they're going to be, you know, catching up to Europe with privacy laws or with consumer protection or whatever. So pretty fascinating. I'm all for faster browsers, and it sounds like that's one of the things that could happen here, because we'll have more, you know, direct competition, so to speak, between the developers and the browsers. Although I'm sure because Apple makes the chips, there's still going to be an advantage for being the creator and the designer of the OS as well as the hardware.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Well, before we do some AI, let's go to the tech correction. Actually, I think you've got a couple, and I just have one. But mine comes from a Substack that is published by the Media and Democracy Project, and this was a post that they had today. They have named Elon Musk the 2023 Disinformer of the Year. And one of the ways that I'm going to try to get this to be relevant for all of us is I had an interaction on Facebook, I think today, with an educator that I've known for a while, and he was talking about Twitter. And I just said, hey, are you considering quitting Twitter? I think every single person should think about what your line is that you're not going to support this thing. Do you have a line? You know, I think we mentioned, although we don't have an article perhaps, that Substack had just flat out said they weren't going to do anything about these Nazis that were very, you know, popular on their platform. And they did take some action, and that was having me go, oh my gosh, am I going to have to, not that I'm on Substack all the time, but it is when I send out a newsletter, which is about monthly, that's where it happens. So this article breaks down, I thought, really well, the criticisms of Musk, and they say, you know, deciding to monetize, disinformers, racists, anti-LGBTQIA, propagandists, misogynists, anti-Semites, and then just a host of things. There are like probably 15 things. And so, you know, my online class, which is all asynchronous, started today for teaching the conspiracies. Why are there so many conspiracy theories? And, you know, there have been conspiracy theories forever, but it does make a difference when a platform fires all kinds of folks who had been there before to try and help moderate content. When a platform that used to, you know, actively try and not promote disinformation doesn't do that anymore, and the owner, you know, actually amplifies and gives all kinds of oxygen to extremist positions and ideas and things that have just really been debunked as false. And so anyway, I think it's a good article, and I really think that all of us as educators, and not just educators, all of us as human beings need to think about who and what we support with our money, with our attention, because we live in an attention economy. And as we share, it is a wonderful thing to be able to share ideas, to be connected to other people. It hurt to leave Twitter. This is an important topic. And so that's kind of why I'll put that out there, because I think if you haven't considered it, it's good to consider, and it's probably the ethics around these things do matter. And there are things to visit with students about in an appropriate way as best we can developmentally. So there's my tech correction article.
Yeah. And I'll just note, I'm off of Twitter too. I have, gone on it maybe two or three times the last couple of weeks. There are some folks that I know will never leave, are unlikely to leave, that are educators, and I understand why that's the case for sure, right? The bottom line is for me is that it's a bummer for me too.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, do you want to do any of those other tech corrections, or do you want to jump to AI?
Let's see here. Actually, those other two. No.
Actually, I think I did. I'll do that CNN one really quick, because that's that's kind of a.
Yeah, let's do that, and then we'll
do your breaking news. There you go. CNN today, January 31st. Accusations, tears, and rants. Five takeaways from today's tech CEO hearing. We have covered these before. We've had these before. We've talked about how the OpenAI hearings seem to have a different tone than some of the earlier ones with tech CEOs that featured, you know, Sundar Pichai of Google and Zuckerberg and Twitter's, you know, before Musk purchased. But we had CEOs of TikTok, of Snap, of Discord, of what was Twitter, now X, and Meta, Facebook, all talking before Congress. And so there were a lot of families of victims that have been harmed. In some cases, you know, they've died, or they're not with us anymore. And they were a really important influence. We had a apology that Zuckerberg gave. And I guess Spiegel, who is the, let's see, CEO of Snap, they both, said apologies to the parents. Anyway, it was quite a hearing. And the tech practices, and, you know, this does give people a podium to stand up and, you know, there's these t-shirts. I'm worth more than $270. Cause anyway, some of these leaked, Meta or Facebook, documents, or maybe they were released by court order, I'm not sure, you know, showed that they had estimated at one time the lifetime value of a teen was $270. So anyway, some of this is, I think, just highlighting the attention economy, the advertising driven economy that we live in, how these platforms make their money, right? Which famously some senators or representatives, you know, had said some things at one point that seemed to highlight that they were not aware of that. But the stories of harm that, you know, parents have shared and they were present to give voice to and to amplify, really did apparently move a lot of people in the room. And so I would say that this is, you know, this aptly fits under tech correction, because the idea of the tech correction, coined by Dr. Neifer, is that we're going to see some kind of regulation in response to the arguably unintended consequences, but the negative impacts of social media, you know, on our society, and the ones that we've had on especially youth, teenage girls, especially those seem to be very well substantiated with research. And we had a lot of stories and tears today in Washington, D.C. as the CEOs faced the public. So I don't know. I mean, I'm not going to hold my breath, but you would think that we might have some kind of action.
Yeah, and I think you make an important point about holding your breath, because the bottom line is that, you know, we've known for a long time that we needed a kind of an adult in the room in regards to these technologies. And there were plenty of opportunities, in my humble opinion, to do that. And as it turns out, it just never happened. And so, yeah, I'm not holding my breath either. But if the kind of social media companies that, you know, where we literally have the CEOs begging for forgiveness in front of Congress, if we can't get those regulated in some way, shape, or form, I don't actually have a lot of hope that we'll be able to do it for AI either.
Your last article is about the Pew report that just is showing the ascendancy of YouTube and TikTok. And wow, those graphs and these kinds of articles are fantastic to look at, if for nothing else than the way that data is summarized visually. Yeah. And so, you know, some of these line graphs showing growth, a third of U.S. adults say they use TikTok, up from 21% in 2021. And so you look at YouTube, which is at 83%, Facebook at 68%, Instagram at 47%. And then you've got a whole lot of other, you know, platforms that are down there. So anyway, I think, it's an important article. Any thoughts that you had about that report?
Yeah. I just wanted to mostly note, really the two main headlines. The first one is the fact that YouTube remains, ubiquitous, according to the, author of the headline. And I would agree. Like YouTube has its issues for sure, but, it's probably a third, maybe even a half of my social or my video diet. And I don't watch a ton of TV. I probably watch 5, 6, 7 hours a week. Maybe a lot of that is series that with my wife, but the bottom line is that I love YouTube. And I still remain a huge, fan of YouTube. And one of the main reasons why that's the case is because there are so many wonderful creators out there that do provide extraordinary opportunities to learn from them. And it's pretty hard to beat that. But the other piece was the true increase in dominance of TikTok. One out of three Americans having used the technology itself. I do know some folks that have started TikTok, recognized how potentially addictive it could be, and stopped before it became a real issue. But the super part of that, too, is that, millennials and Gen Z, a lot of them utilize that exclusively for news and also for looking things up. I've seen that research elsewhere. That one I'm a little less I mean, I'm concerned about it, but my guess is that the poor answers you might get from that after a while would be a bit befuddling, just because of, you know, if you're not getting the useful information you're looking for, at some point you go elsewhere. So.
Absolutely. Well, and there again highlights the need for media literacy and web literacy and the ability to vet sources and all those good kinds of things, because these platforms that, you know, it's just a lot harder to check your sources on a reel, you know, or even a regular video than it is, you know, reading an article or something like
yep.
that. Okay, well, how about the AI world? We have 15 minutes. It's 1 AR. Go.
Well, and on the top. So let's see here. Let me do a couple of quick ones here about the impact of AI. There were two great articles that were on my reading list this week. The first one is that Google News is actually in some cases boosting news that is basically AI generated fluff, and I should post the alternative link to this, the archive.ph link instead. But it basically talks about how the Google News algorithm is starting to pick up on a lot of the issues regarding pages that have been clearly AI generated for SEO purposes, right? And I've had some examples of that happen to me, and not in the way of like I've ran into junk articles, but I got a Google News alert a couple of weeks ago that there was an article about Montana Digital Academy, my day jobs program, and it was clearly junk AI generated website that was supposedly about energy, and it had energy articles and a bunch of junk articles, and everything had kind of that weird tone of AI. And so clearly what was happening was they were using that to get more trust scores in the Google algorithm so they would rise. But I am extremely concerned, right? What I've been telling people is that the critical thinking part of AI is the vetting component, right? And if you're not an expert in it, you should be at the very least bouncing ideas that you get from AI off of a good quality Google search. But if Google becomes littered with e-junk that's generated by AI, and by e-junk, I'm not saying that AI generated content is junk. What I'm saying is that it's easy to create junk with AI that serves a purpose like search engine optimization. And yeah, yikes, super gross. But I am concerned that the web itself may decrease in its usefulness, maybe dramatically, because of the rise of junk content.
This is like a hurricane that is approaching the coast, and the rain is just starting to fall, and there's a few drops, but this horrifically powerful maelstrom is coming, and I think it's going to wreak havoc. And we're seeing these signs that people have talked about these things, but yes, I do think that, you know, Google has lots of smart engineers, and you know, we're an ingenious group of folks, but man, the power of AI is such, and its ability to, you know, pass the Turing test, as well as what the LSAT and the MCAT and all, you know, all the GRE, all these different tests. It's going to be very, very challenging. So if you're a young person out there considering a life of coding, we need you. We need you to help us solve these issues. I would like to see us bring back the RSS reader. Dr. Neifer, you know, I wonder yeah. about that, because, you know, when you can directly subscribe to somebody's site that they have and it's not algorithmically massaged. I was listening to a podcast this week, I think, where they were, and maybe, I don't know if it'll be one that I'll mention, but just, you know, those days that was not monetizable, I think, in the ways that people wanted to monetize social media. But maybe we'll end up returning to some of that. And if you don't know what I am talking about, you know, in the late 90s, when blogs were just coming around, we had these RSS readers, and you would, you know, have this RSS reader that you would subscribe to different people's blogs, and then you would be able to see what was new, and you were just directly getting the feed of what had been posted from them. There was no Google, there was no Facebook, there wasn't an intermediary. And so that's interesting. And I know that Feedburner is a different thing related to that. What is it? I can't pull my phone up because I'm using it as my camera, but there is an RSS feed reader that I still have that I haven't used in a long, long time, but I don't know. It's going to be curious. I will say that the Fediverse, which is not only a, you know, like Mastodon, this is the new Twitter, but it's a whole protocol for identity management and identity credentialing, as well as data portability and interoperability between different systems. I think there's a lot of hope and promise to that, but it doesn't mean there's not going to be a lot of garbage and pollution that's going to be out there. And so I think we can say with confidence, AI is going to give us more of this garbage that 404 Media was reporting.
Well, let's see. Other AI stuff. Oh, yeah, the other one was about Nightshade. Oh, I think we mentioned this one maybe in past week, but or past episode of the podcast. But Nightshade is software that you can put images through that a creator creates, so an artist generated image, and it adds something to the mix of the image that not only renders it useless as AI training data, it actually becomes a poison pill for the model. And so it can actually cause destruction to the model. And I think that this is not the answer to the question about how we would deal with intellectual property in AI, but already it's had an extraordinary download rate, and a lot of artists are heralding this as a early way to deal with it.
That is absolutely science fiction sounding. That is really wild. Okay. Well, let's do a couple articles, sadly, about AI image harms. There were a couple different titles I thought of using for this, but this is from a number of these are from Ars Technica. Ars Technica reported on January 28th that Toxic Telegram Group produced X's X-rated fake AI Taylor Swift images, report said. Part of the reason I started down the rabbit hole of conspiracies and culture wars and teaching the conspiracies, you know, had to do with, podcast called The Prophet, but it was basically about how trolls would operate and groups of young kids all over the world, you know, would work with these folks and, you know, target people and target individuals. Well, Telegram is now utilized by a lot of different groups. It's interesting. It's like huge in Russia, for all kinds of groups to use it. But the bottom line is, this article describes the way in which apparently Microsoft's open tool, which is it called Designer, was allegedly used to create this non-consensual porn. It's called Designer, Microsoft's free text image AI designer. And so they were able to subvert the guardrails that were on there. And instead of typing in Taylor Swift, which was prohibited, they would say Taylor, single apostrophe singer end apostrophe Swift, and create these sexualized images, which then were, you know, spread all over social media. So that is definitely, and I haven't talked to my students about this, but I think we might have mentioned Casey Newton's article on Platformer last week, which talked about this really being kind of a canary in the coal mine and a warning sign of what is not only what's to come, but what is happening now. That article cites something that I don't think we covered on the podcast, but it's certainly worth knowing in a school context because it happened at a school. This was Ars Technica back on November 2nd of 2023, and the headline was, "Teen boys use AI to make fake nudes of classmates, sparking police probe." And so this was at Westfield High School in New Jersey. Maybe we did talk about this article, I'm not sure. But just like, unfortunately, every single high school in the entire country and maybe the world has been affected by sexting and by the sharing of images that, you know, have caused a lot of grief and anxiety. I feel confident with the proliferation of AI tools that articles like this that do affect schools and school administrators. These things are happening now in, again, just like light rain, but there's a storm coming. And so I think it will behoove us not only, again, to think about how these kind of things can be regulated. In some cases, there's not laws against these things in communities or in states, but also thinking about how we'll address this in school, how talking about issues similar to this, maybe not the exact thing that's happening, because this, the day in which we live, right? If somebody says, hey, there's been non-consensual porn created about Taylor Swift, guess what? You know, kids can Google that and they will. So we have to be careful about what we amplify in telling students and talking about in school, but we absolutely need to be having sort of the same digital citizenship conversations and media literacy conversations that you've heard us talk about a lot. And there's some more articles there, but we're going to run short of time. So your thoughts, sir?
I mean, it's disgusting. I'm not sure if I've told this story or not, but there was a big controversy in the high school I graduated from 25 years ago. A student in that school had published a website with the 10 hottest freshman girls list. And the student had gotten in trouble because he pulled kids out of classes to take their photo for the website, utilizing passes for the journalism department, so creating all sorts of UGG there. And I just think about the incredible difference between that reaction and then what is clearly, you know, monumentally worse activities. And you know, I remain an AI centrist. I really do believe that we need to both embrace and be careful about these tools all wrapped into one. But let's not forget that AI represents extremely powerful tools, right? And that there's almost no barrier to entry to get access to tools that can wreak extraordinary havoc.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, we could cover an article or two more, or how about this one about ChatGPT's new at mentions? This is, I guess it didn't actually go into a subcategory, but I just saw this one before the show. This is today. You can now create, and I think Jason and I think both of us have been creating these custom GPTs. I think your organization may even be creating some of those. And so now they have brought in this capability of using sort of like we would use on social media where we at mention someone and then that will come up in your feed. You can at mention a custom GPT that you've created, which they are describing it could be a personality, but then you can access that GPT's, you know, access it. You can, you know, if it's one that's been optimized for the pedagogy of online and blended learning, then, you know, you can bring that into the conversation and have it contribute. And so towards the end of the article, they say, this seems to sort of portend a future where GPTs as independent agents, I'm quoting the article here, quote, could work together as a team to fulfill more complex tasks directed by the user. And I'll share this. My wife kind of helped me think of this. Of course, this is going to be, you know, our transcript is being, you know, put online. I was thinking about that today. Everything we say is like written in stone now. But I think that I've got a book I'm almost done with. And then the next one I think I'm going to do is going to be called Playing with AI, Cultivating a DIY AI Mindset. Because being able to creatively think about, oh, how could I solve this problem? Oh, how could I use data? How could I analyze that? We're going to have tools like, what was the school one that you had recommended? These different tools that have like, hey, here's 50 different, you know, prompts and things like that, which is basically some people who have come up with prompts and they've written custom GPTs that plug into the API to do these things. But the truth is you can just do most of those things yourself. Maybe not if it uses customized data, but I think this is, This is another, I mean, this isn't an exciting headline that's going to be at the top of all the news reports, but it, you know, sort of like Apple with, and this, you know, coming again, faster chips that have, you know, doubled speed. I mean, we're just seeing the capability continue to get better and better. And so I think this is very interesting. And it's, have you accessed any of the stores GPTs to like access ones that have been built by other people yet?
Yeah, I have. And they're interesting. If for no other reason than I you know, tend to look at them for models, but, at some point there's going to be a good way to have a catalog of those, right? That looks more like an app store than kind of the haphazard way they're demonstrated right now. The other thing I'm also really interested in is that I do wonder how many of the really functional ones may be violating intellectual property rights, like things like books, et cetera, that are part of the training data. But so far, I mean, a lot of interesting stuff out there.
Yeah, it is going to be super interesting to see how copyright weighs into this. I know we've talked on the show that like teachers pay teachers is an issue with this because like you might have had some of your stuff taken without permission, but unless you buy it, you don't have visibility into what they've really used. And so if the GPTs themselves are opaque and don't allow you to say, oh, look, they uploaded these, you know, four books that, you know, generally people have to pay for. It's very, very interesting how all of that is going to play out. But I'll say this, I am using my custom GPTs basically every day, you know, and I have a visualization one that'll just, you know, ask me for the aspect ratio and, you know, for the style and, you know, creates visualizations. And sometimes I'm using, you know, Unsplash images and other places, but it is when you are using this thing regularly, it's just mind blowing how powerful and I will say creative it can be. And I know that it's combining a lot of things, but what is creativity? I mean, sometimes maybe we have an original idea, but a lot of times our ideas are, you know, remixes and combinations, new syntheses, to quote Hegel. You know, you're bringing together stuff that you're putting together, and the ways that ChatGPT-4 specifically is able to do that just makes my mind go.
Yep, me too.
Okay, well, believe it or not, we have managed to talk for another hour yet again.
I'm looking here to see if there's anything we absolutely have to do this week. Hey, I want to mention one other thing about that, the mentioning multiple AI bots in one conversation, where I think that's going to be interesting for users like myself and those that do things like write curriculum. We've experimented with several bots at my day job, including ones that are specific to assessment and other ones that are specific to formative assessment and other ones that have Montana State standards built into them and others have national standards or other ways to look at various pieces of distance learning courses. And it's super cool. But if you try to add all that stuff to one single bot, it tends to get a little messy and it has kind of a blender effect where it's not going to always have a consistent response. So one of the things I think could be a real cool possibility here is that the ability to pull in other custom GPTs into a centralized conversations means, you know, like I want you, bot one, to write this thing. And then I want bot two to come up with formative assessment ideas. And I want bot three to come up with traditional objective assessment ideas, et cetera, et cetera. I think that could be a really, really interesting, way to go about that process.
And if you think about coding and the potential of these systems to write their own code, and I'm not just thinking of a dystopian, you know, try to destroy humanity. I'm thinking about even now I am descriptively saying, I want to do this. I want JavaScript, which will do this, which will run on a Google site and not call external APIs and will such and such. It's incredible. And so the barriers to entry to be creating code and crafting code are going to, I think, keep coming down. And I think that this should really cause us to rethink some of what we're doing in school. Okay. The math curriculum has stayed pretty much like it is for a long, long time. I will say the incredibly radical thing that I don't think every kid needs to be suffering through Algebra 2 and, you know, doing factoring, whatever. I don't even know all the things. It's been a while since I've helped my kids with it, but it's just, I think coding and doing some, you know, prompt engineering and looking at how scripting works and computational thinking, we got to be developing this, folks. And if you're not offering that kind of experience for your students, as electives, and you're not trying to beat the bushes to make it engaging and fun and draw students to it, and then also I think talking about what's required, those are all conversations we need to be having.
Yep, absolutely.
Okay, shall we geek of the week it?
Yep, let's do it. Why don't you start, Dr. Pryor?
Okay, two quick ones. They're both podcasts. The first one is the Hard Fork podcast from last week. We have mentioned numerous times that Hard Fork is one of Jason and my favorite listens. This is from January 26th. And the reason why I think it is so good is it is one of the most succinct and comprehensive descriptions of what we have seen happen with media and news and journalism in terms of disruption and disintermediation. They just do a great job doing that. And then the other one is going to be from, I don't know if you listen to this one, Voices of DARPA. Are you a Voices of DARPA listener?
No.
DARPA is the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, and one of my best friends, in fact, one of my debate partners when I was a junior, had his last duty assignment with DARPA before he went to work for Lockheed. This is, you know, Jason is definitely one of the smartest people I know, and I will put this other friend, you know, up there in the stratosphere with him too. DARPA has a lot of very smart people, and so they have a podcast called Voices of DARPA. This is their October 2023 episode, and it is called the AI Cyber Challenge, CTF Code and Critical Infrastructure. But kind of pairing it with what we were talking about with the FBI to start the show, they say here in the episode very clearly, we've had numerous high-level military officers, other elected officials, other intelligence folks say China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, they are in our critical infrastructure systems. And they can wreak extreme havoc. And so there's a lot of things to say about this, but one of them is we need students who have coding capabilities, and we need people who can help defend the nation in cyberspace. But DARPA, that this is not one I listen to every week, but it really is great. So you can add it to your list.
Okay, great. And I would like to share this week an e-commerce website called drop.com. It used to be called MassDrop, but drop.com is a website that either custom develops interesting, nerdy things, or gets a relatively inexpensive deals on kind of high-end electronics. Things like mechanical keyboards, digital audio condensers, that sort of thing. And I was reminded of this. I bought a couple pairs of headphones on here before as gifts for others, and then I bought a tube amp, a headphone amp, which uses old-fashioned tubes to add a richer sound to it. And I spent well under $100 for it. And it's such a premium listening experience that I am very, 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 very impressed. So I just wanted to share that. It's a pretty, pretty fun website, especially if you like a high-end kind of wacko electronics, because that's what this stuff is. So
the Lord of the Rings Rohan artisan keycap has my attention.
Yeah,
right now.
Obviously that's the stuff that everyone needs. So, Dr. Fryer, where can people find you on the internet?
I am at westfryer.com/after, and you can get all the links there. How about you?
I am at AIcenters.com, where you can find me, and I sometimes am on social media, sort of. But hey, this is the Epic Situation. We're a once-a-week podcast on Wednesday nights at 7 p.m. Mountain Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, sometime in the middle of the night UTC. Hey, we'd love it if you joined us live on either YouTube or Facebook, but if you can't, download the podcast wherever finer podcasts are aggregated. You can also find the archive videos on Facebook or YouTube. Not to mention, you can go to our website, edtechsr.com, and get both the links. And also, you can download tiny MP3s if that's your thing. So, hey, stay safe, stay savvy, and we'll see you next time on the EdTech Situation Room. Good night.
Good night, everybody.